in reaction to Sunday night's mass shooting in Las Vegas, researchers are pointing out that there are restrictions on federal funding of gun control and gun violence prevention research. Groups that represent these social science researchers say they want those restrictions lifted.
Scott Jasek is an editor for Inside Higher Ed. He's written about calls for more research on gun violence. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what restrictions are in place when it comes to federal funding for gun violence-related research?
Sure. In 1996, the Centers for Disease Control sponsored research that offended the pro-gun lobby. The research found that having a gun in your home doesn't necessarily make you more safe. Congress responded at the behest of the NRA and others by saying that the CDC could no longer support research that, quote, may be used to advocate or promote gun control. And that has effectively shut down CDC research. There's been a little NIH research, but that is being phased out now as well.
Now, this doesn't mean there's no CDC research at all about gun violence. They do track things like gun deaths, gun homicides, and suicides, and some of the basic stats, right?
Correct, but they can't sponsor research that would be the kind of social science research that might look at policies. They can't necessarily support a study that might look at, well, do waiting periods work, or are there effective ways to screen out people whose mental illnesses might make it unsafe for them to own and use a gun. And there's a lot of fear in science agencies of offending Congress or the gun lobby. Right now, Congress is controlled by people who are supportive of the gun lobby. So there's worry about this. And a lot of the policy questions could conceivably benefit from studies saying this approach would work, this approach might not work.
In your piece, you wrote about different social science research groups responding to this. Again, this has come up in the past. What kind of things are we hearing?
So again, what they're saying is we need to do research. And it's important to remember that good social science research looking at the impact of various policies requires money. And so a researcher at University of Wisconsin or anywhere for that matter would need grants to apply for. And what the associations are pointing out is that research has been shut down. And they talk about this issue comes up whenever there is one of these tragedies, like we just saw in Las Vegas. It came up after Sandy Hook, came up after Orlando. But to date, it's been the Congress hasn't been willing to lift the ban.
Big picture, apart not just looking at gun violence here, how important is federal funding for any kind of health research going on at universities and other institutions going on around the country?
It's very important. I mean, look, the NIH, CDC combined provide billions of dollars in grants. This stuff is expensive. And when you look at, say, state appropriations to public universities, it's not for research. It's for sort of their core undergraduate education missions primarily. And what happens here, this is sort of the latest illustration, that when some of the tough health policy questions deal with hot button issues, many times politicians get upset. So, for instance, in the past, there's been criticism of research on needle exchange programs, even though many people say it was essential to do that research to come up with policies so people wouldn't share needles and spread terrible diseases. Similarly, research on safe sex and what would motivate people to have safe sex or not is a crucial part of the scientific fight on AIDS. And yet, because some of these studies offend some people, they get very controversial and people yell about them or, in some cases, try to ban them.
We're talking to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, looking at federal restrictions on funding for different kinds of gun violence-related social science research. There have been recent renewed calls from research organizations calling for that to be loosened up. Scott, groups like the NRA and others are worried, I think, that universities in particular are liberal organizations. They have a built-in bias of sorts. They're going to come in with conclusions that they want to reach, and the research they do will then find those conclusions. What do researchers and these organizations say to that?
Well, they would point out that federal research doesn't just go to anybody who has an idea. There's a peer review process. And so someone who wanted to do research on this would have to show, among other things, that they were doing a legitimate study, that even if there was a hypothesis, there wasn't a predetermined conclusion. If there's a predetermined conclusion, a good peer review would reject that. We're not talking about money to write an op-ed with somebody's opinion that they don't need a grant for. But we're talking about studies that would be rigorously analyzed. Is this good science? Is there a control group? Is there a large enough sample to draw certain conclusions? If they determined that it was just trying to prove one thing, a good peer review panel would say no.
How does gun research funding compare with research into other health issues that might have comparable death tolls in the United States?
So one of the groups of scientists that have been pushing to get this ban lifted did this really fascinating comparison. In the last 40 years, there have been about 400 cases of cholera in the United States, and there have been 212 research grants. There have been 1,337 cases of diphtheria, 66 research grants. More than 4 million firearms injuries, 3 grants. And so the reality is that firearms injuries are a public health issue. We're not talking about research, you know, on what does the bullet do, but we're talking about research on public policy that might inform lawmakers to develop good policy.
Just looking around in comment sections on articles on related issues, people raise the idea, well, this is the Centers for Disease Control, the National Institutes for Health. A lot of people don't think of guns and firearms as a health issue that is in the purview of those organizations.
And I think respectfully that they're incorrect. These organizations look at health broadly. They do research on such topics as driving while intoxicated, using drugs that are illegal or maybe should be illegal. So they look at a range of behaviors. I also think, in this you will hear from scientists, on many health issues, the path to either prevention or a cure is as much about human behavior as it is about the science. So this is a very much a part of the way science of health works these days on many issues. It's not just discovering what caused a certain situation, but how do you prevent it? And that, a lot of that, has to do with behavior.
Are there examples here in Wisconsin where academics and lawmakers at any level have butted heads on issues like these?
Well, sure. In Wisconsin, I mean, when I was last on your show was when some legislators were upset about a course on whiteness. And likewise, there have been disputes about research involving abortion or fetuses. And what happens is you have legislators trying to dictate what professors should study. Generally, certainly within academia, that is frowned upon, not out of the belief that professors should be able to do whatever they want, but out of the belief that you have systems like peer review or institutional review boards that look at any research involving human beings. You have systems where experts review proposals and either approve them or not. You don't want, many people don't want legislators making those decisions, in the same way that you wouldn't want legislators telling farmers when to harvest their crops. Legislators, you can assume, are very smart, but they have areas of expertise. And what research a professor should do historically has not been one of those areas of expertise.
We're talking to Scott Jasek, editor at Inside Higher Ed, looking at why the CDC is barred from funding a lot of kinds of research on gun violence and gun violence prevention.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. What is your take on this? Do you think that the CDC should study gun violence? What do you think about the ban on studying gun violence? Should the federal government fund gun control research? You can call in now at 800-642-1234, and you can also email ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up here on Central Time. We're picking up our conversation now about limits on federal funding for gun violence research. Scott Jasek stays with us. He's editor for Inside Higher Ed.
And you can join in our conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the limits of federal funding on research into gun violence? What do you think needs more research in particular? What questions need answering when it comes to gun control? And do you think the federal government should fund gun control research? Call in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll go right to our callers. Val is on the line in Waukesha. Val, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just call in and say that I think that if not the CDC, there needs to be some sort of agency that's funded to study it. And if no, for no other reason, the fact that it seems the NRA is so set against it, that there must be something that's being hidden or that's going to be uncovered that could not be just Second Amendmented away. That would point to the need for some sort of control.
Val, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, any thoughts on what Val had to say?
Yeah, I mean, this is what the purpose of research is to find things out. I don't think a research study that just said we're looking for 10 reasons why this gun control measure should be adopted would necessarily be approved. But if you look at the various proposals, they have common elements. How do you prevent, you know, what is going to prevent gun violence? And some of those findings could have an impact on lawmakers.
Val, thanks a lot for the call. Scott, do you have a sense of what kind of studies people are chomping at the bit to do if they could get the funding to do it?
They're looking to study policies. They're looking, you know, such as waiting periods. They're looking to answer questions such as what are the characteristics of someone that might make them unsafe to have a gun or access to a gun. There's a lot of discussion of these issues where people say, based on their perhaps common sense or gut instinct, what those factors are. But many would say there needs to be research. The study I mentioned that caused this ban to put in place challenged something that the NRA says, in that it found that having a gun at home doesn't make you more safe and increases certain kinds of violence, even if it protects against other kinds of violence. All of these are hotly contested issues, frequently being debated just on what people think, not on actual research. That's the idea here.
And as I understand it, the way this is done, this isn't technically a ban on funding for research. People could apply for grants. Theoretically, the CDC or National Institutes of Health could give a grant to this kind of research, but there's a sense of fear. There's a gray area that it would be really easy to waltz across and then run into trouble. Is that right?
Right. And the Congress has in the past punished the CDC by cutting its budget for funding this area of research. And the CDC and the NIH fund all kinds of very important research, and so they worry about things that might set off congressional critics.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Kyle is with us in Muskego. Kyle, hi.
Hi. I think in this talk about violence and what causes it, I think we need to focus less on the method and more on the why and what pushes people to do this. The terrorist that just committed that mass murder, he used guns, but he also had explosive materials at one of his homes. And if he had decided to go that route and built something similar to the Oklahoma City bomb, and used that at the concert instead of guns, we could be looking at a much higher death count. So I don't think the how is as important as the why and how to stop the violence in the first place.
Kyle, thanks for calling. And Scott, is that an important distinction to make, what motivates violence and the means used to carry it out?
Well, in fact, I mean, there is federal research on what motivates terrorists. deaths. There is federal research on issues such as why people might join a group like Al-Qaeda and cause harm to people here and elsewhere, using any number of tactics to do so. So I think the key thing on this issue is that this is the issue being left out. There is already a study underway, numerous studies, that have helped people who are developing public policy figure out what should we do to minimize the chances of more people joining terrorist groups. So, yes, no one's saying that only gun violence should be studied.
Kyle, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mike on the line in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. I think that last comment is similar to where I was headed, but I remember the debate and the discussion when these controls came down. And the debate really came down to that it was every appearance of CDC and others were biasing their research by making the very subject that they were looking for causes or reasons to control guns and so forth. If this was part of violence research or emergency room, trauma or whatever, and it was done as an unbiased look, and they happened to include firearms, that might be acceptable. But when you go at it with a target and a focus, specifically focusing on gun control type issues, then no, they shouldn't be funded.
Mike, thanks for the call. I guess, Scott, some researchers might say we do have a category of death, suicide, and homicide that does involve firearms, just as we have a category of deaths that involves cholera. How do you sort that out?
Well, I mean, again, what this is about is what they are told they can't study. I also think it's important to remember that if you look back in time, there was a period when the researchers who came out and said that smoking cigarettes is dangerous were attacked as some sort of crazy biased academics. Well, as time went on, those findings were validated by everybody and now aren't disputed. Sometimes research will lead in directions that people don't want to hear about. And that's why today, for instance, in addition to, well, that issue has been solved, you still see studies on factors that will motivate people to smoke or not smoke. It's how you tackle public health issues, and it simply that researchers may have an opinion going in, that's not the basis of judging their work. The basis of judging their work is this a good scientific test? Are they looking at multiple theories? Is there real proof? Have they designed this in a fair way? It's not just a case of somebody who doesn't like guns saying, give me some money so I can say guns are bad.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, looking at federal restrictions on funding for gun violence research. Back to our callers. John is with us in West Salem. John, hi.
Hello. I've been listening for the last 5 or 10 minutes, and I appreciate your guests in wanting to have research into gun issues. But I never, ever hear the contributions that are given to our legislation and given to our president's campaign, which was the amount of $30 million by the NRA. Now, if the NRA is controlling our legislation and our presidency, and both houses are Republican, how in the world do you think that you're going to get any research money?
John, thanks for the call. John Scott is worried about the sway of campaign donations in having anything change here.
Well, past history would say he's right to be worried about that. The Congress has been asked before to lift this ban. Congress has not. It is true that there are many congressional figures who have close ties and receive a lot of money from the NRA, people always ask, when might things change? And they wonder that after the tragedy in which those elementary school kids were killed in Connecticut and after the Orlando nightclub. I don't know. It's a uphill climb for the reasons that caller just identified, but sometimes the public mood does change, and who knows if this is the time or if it will be some later period.
Thanks for the call, John. And Scott, as we wrap up, a wider issue even than research into gun violence, you have a concern about academic freedom in general.
Yes. Well, if you have members of Congress or members of state legislatures banning certain kinds of research, you're limiting the inquiry that people have. We get out of academic research, we get lots of ideas that never work, that people look for cures or policies, and then they find they're not working. But we also get, and it's striking this being Nobel Prize week, we get brilliant ideas that change the world. That comes from people being free to go where they want to study and also being able to get adequate support to study. And that's just the nature of great research.
Do you see support for research in general, again, outside of the particulars of the firearms issue we're talking about? Do you see that in danger?
Well, I mean, there is strong bipartisan support, I would say, in general for health research because everyone has diseases that they worry about, that their loved ones had, and they want study of that. What I see less support for are state appropriations for public universities, so it becomes harder for public universities to maintain the great faculties who will come up with the ideas and land grants to do research.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Scott Jasek, editor for Inside Higher Ed. He joined us to talk about the news that scholars and scholarly groups are calling for an end to federal funding restrictions on gun violence research.
Coming up, we'll look at the arts in our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our series, First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today, with a look at the role of the arts.
Jasmine Espinoza Church is an independent author. Her books include Dreamcatcher and the forthcoming book, Crown of Thorns. She's a member of the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians. Jasmine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What made you, Jasmine, decide that you wanted to be a writer?
I've always wanted to be a writer ever since I can remember. Even before I could write, I would make up these stories and I would have my grandmother and my mom write them down for me because I just didn't know how to write. And ever since then, I've been writing and doing creative things in one form or another. Didn't really decide to make it a career of mine until I moved out of my parents' house and moved to Michigan, and I thought, why not take my passion and my love for writing in words and turn it into a career that I can do for the rest of my life?
I also read that you said that on the reservation where you grew up in Wisconsin, that there wasn't a lot to do, so you became a super intense reader from a young age.
Yeah, definitely. In many parts of Wisconsin, I'm sure you guys can relate that there's a lot of farmland and a lot of stretches in between cities. So I lived about 30 minutes away from the nearest town. We didn't go out very often. So I found myself sitting inside, sort of with my nose in a book, trying to find out all these new books and all these new different authors that I could relate to. And I really made a connection with reading through that.
So you said 30 minutes to the nearest town. Where was your reservation?
It's in a small town called Bowler. It's about 30, 40 minutes away from the nearest town, which is Shawano, Wisconsin, which is about an hour from Green Bay. So we were really far from the nearest actual big city.
So was it the library? Were you the kid who was always at the library?
Yeah, definitely. We were even 30 minutes away from the nearest library, so Whenever we did go to town and my parents would go shopping and check out stores, I would always ask to be dropped off at the library, and I'd spend hours there just looking through books and making a big stack so that I would have enough to last me until we came back to town.
Now, you said that you moved to Michigan and you thought, you know what, I could turn this into something I do for the rest of my life. How did you learn to write? How did you become the writer, from the reader to the writer?
I feel like if you read a lot and you read enough, you sort of get a feel for the basic structure of a story, what people want within like a certain genre. And what I always read was young adult literature, like teen books, when you think of books like Divergent and things like that. And when you take a look at all those books all together, you get sort of a feel for what people want. And as I was reading, I was thinking to myself, hey, I could do this. I could write these. So then I started giving it a shot and writing my first full-length novel at 19. And it turned out pretty good, so I decided I'd keep doing it.
And I understand that you publish as an independent author now. You self-publish. Why did you make that choice?
Because a lot of people don't know about the literary world is that as an author, if you get an agent and you decide to go through the traditional publishing route, there's a lot of stipulations and a lot of things you don't have control over, like cover design, all the names in your book, and like certain things are subject to change when you sell the rights to them. And I really wanted my stories to keep the really wholesome and down-to-earth feel that they had. And a lot of traditional publishing houses change a lot that you're not able to control. So I decided to take the reins and be able to take my own career into my own hands.
Well, and one of the things that you do is your books have Native American characters in them, and it sounds like maybe that's something you didn't have in the books you were reading when you were growing up, so you're finally getting to write the books that you wanted to read with the characters who were like you.
Definitely. Growing up, it was always hard for me to find a character that I could relate to and I could really see myself in, and I knew a lot of people on the reservations had the same issue, not even just in books, but there's a huge underrepresentation of Native Americans in movies and magazines and things like that. And there's not really much I can do about the movies and the magazines and things, but I could change the underrepresentation in books. So that's what I decided to do. So other kids on reservations can grow up reading my characters and really imagining themselves as them.
Jasmine Espinoza Church is with us right now. She's an independent author. Her books include Dreamcatcher and the forthcoming Crown of Thorns. And Jasmine, with that in mind, about writing what you wanted to see when you were growing up, now that you can do that, what are you out to accomplish with your writing?
I really want to be able to give youth a voice, the kids that are underrepresented in the literature. I want to be able to have them be able to feel themselves in my writing, and I want to be able to convey a diverse set of characters that you wouldn't normally see in a traditionally published book. And I want to be able to show other kids, not only on reservations, but across the United States, that they can do anything that they put their mind to.
And have you heard from the readers of your books, maybe Native American kids across the country, who say, you know, thanks for writing these?
Yeah, I definitely have. I love when I get emails and comments on social media and things like that from people who have read my books. And a lot of them, the most common thing I actually hear is not really about my books in general, but it's about the fact that I published a book, so they think that they can publish a book too, which is really inspiring because so many people are coming out of the woodwork now, that people that I know and people that I've never even met, that tell me that I inspired them to write a book too, because before they felt like it wasn't possible and it wasn't an attainable goal. But now that they see me accomplishing it and me becoming successful at it, they think to themselves that maybe they can do it too. And that's really something that I enjoy to hear.
Now, one of your books, Dreamcatcher, is about a post-apocalyptic world, Native American characters. I wonder if you had any more insights into that topic as you watch some of, you know, for instance, the Dakota Access Pipeline protests unfolding.
The Dakota Access Pipeline protest and the whole controversy around that is actually what inspired my book, Dreamcatcher. It's at a time where a lot of my Native American friends and everything, they were traveling to the protest to do their part and make their voices heard and things like that. But I, being a mother, I just had a son, and he was about like 2 or 3 months old at the time when the whole controversy erupted completely. and it wasn't really in my best interest to travel all the way from Michigan to North Dakota to do my part and make my voice heard. So I decided to do what I could with what I had, and I decided to write my take on what the world would be like if the Dakota Access Pipeline was pushed through and if, by any chance, something did malfunction with it. So the whole storyline is based off of in a post-apocalyptic world that was triggered by the explosion of a pipeline, and things sort of dominoed out of control, and then we get stuck with this racially, what's the opposite of diverse?
Homogenous.
Yes, that. Racially that. World where my main character has sort of never seen anybody outside of her race because all races were separated.
And Jasmine, as we wrap up, I want to ask you, what advice do you have for other writers who are out there who are trying to get their careers off the ground like you did?
My best advice would probably be to keep writing. And a lot of times in the beginning of the process, it feels like you're never going to finish it. It feels like you're never going to find somebody to believe in your dream. But all it takes is one person to see that your book has potential and to believe in it for you to have the motivation to continue and to go on. So to just keep doing what you're doing and doing what you love, and not to compromise your story for the sake of other people's approval.
Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jasmine Espinoza Church, author of Dreamcatcher and the forthcoming book Crown of Thorns. She joined us to talk about why she became an author.
Coming up, we'll talk to a musician whose work as a historian for her tribe influenced her music. Stay with us on Central Time. We continue our look at the role of the arts as part of our series First Wisconsinites, Dispatches from Native American Life in Wisconsin Today.
Kelly Jackson is an award-winning musician from the Badger State. She's a singer, songwriter, philanthropist, and tribal advocate. She's a member of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Kelly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you first got involved with music, making music?
Oh, boy. I have been exposed to music for as long as I can remember. My uncles and father were musicians, and I can remember sitting up until the wee hours of the morning listening to them play guitar, and they used to make me sing every song from Johnny Cash to Patsy Cline. So that's really been rooted in my spirit for as long as I can remember.
So after that, you ended up picking up, what, a guitar? Was that your first instrument?
It was. I lost my father when I was very young, and his brother stepped up and sort of took the role as my father, and he bought me my first guitar when I was 11. And I think I wrote my first song and composed it and performed it for my school in fifth grade, I think, was the first
time.
Wow. Yeah, so I have definitely been doing music for a long time. And I think that, you know, inspiration-wise, my father, my real father, played guitar as well and sang. So my father, my stepfather, really wanted me to be able to do that as well.
And so you mentioned you've got Johnny Cash in your background. You've got Patsy Cline. Are those influences? How would you describe your music now?
Well, they've certainly impacted my music, but I would say probably my most powerful influence is my father, obviously, and also love sort of the soulful sounds of Pyra Fay and Buffy St. Marie, who are some amazing Indigenous women artists. I also love Etta James, Josh Stone, Susan Tedeschi, sort of the soulful sounds, and I think that all of those women inspire my music in some way.
We have a clip from the title track of your first album, and it's called Spirit of a Woman. Let's take a listen.
She's got the spirit, oh, spirit of a woman. She's got the spirit.
When did you put it together that for you music is about storytelling and bearing witness and honoring women in your life and in the past?
Well, you know, Spirit of a Woman is the first album that I actually produced, and I think I had been doing music my whole life and had, you know, notebooks filled with songs and wanted to just kind of create a legacy piece with Spirit of a Woman. But, you know, honestly, I think I was empowered by the fact that I wouldn't be where I'm at without some of the strongest women in my life. So I really wanted to do a tribute album to, you know, really showcase the fact that women are working really hard. And it's a really hard balance to be able to provide for your career, your community, and, you know, your family. So I think it's something I wanted to be sure to shout out to all the women out there who are making it happen. And I, again, wouldn't be where I'm at without some of those really powerful and amazing women.
And your first album was That Spirit of a Woman, released in 2012, and it was successful. It won a Native American Music Association Award for Best Americana Album of the Year. And that emphasis that you have on honoring the women who have made you stronger and made you who you are, that hasn't been just about this album. That's been an entire life calling for you, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I think when I first released Spirit of a Woman, I had no idea. Really, it was just kind of a legacy piece. I wanted to share something with my children. And I started to perform all over, and people would come up, women would come up and say, you know, things like, I've been so inspired by that particular song, or it's just really uplifting. And you know, I think I've always had this message that we lift as we climb rather than kind of the crabs in a bucket and pull each other back down. So I think that message has resonated in my music, but also in a mission to further that work is I started a co-founded a nonprofit organization called Spirit of a Woman, which provides professional and personal development for women and girls. So I'm really excited about that. And I think it's been the foundation has been music, but obviously it's, you know, flowered into a much bigger effort and work.
And where is that effort today? Where do you see that going?
Well, I'm obviously we're just getting started and there's a lot of work to be done, but the first program that we were able to launch, and Danielle Yancey, who's my co-founding partner, we launched Indigenous Girls Rock Camp, which is the most amazing thing, by the way. It has got to be the coolest thing I've ever done. We teach girls ages 8 to 18 how to play an instrument. They write an original song, and they perform it for a major music venue. And it really does inspire, I think, some empowerment on the part of the girls. I kind of remember the first time that I was on the stage at my school performing a song that I wrote, and just how liberating and empowering it was. So I think that Indigenous Girls Rock Camp is a chance to radiate that onto other girls who may not have access to, you know, music. And so we're hoping to give them some empowerment and also create some new opportunities for tribal communities throughout the country.
Yeah, let's talk a little more about that, because the music industry, as you know, it's still one of these places that is still dominated by men, and in particular still dominated by white men. And rock and roll, you look at the icons, it's largely white men. What is it like for you to be seeing the next generation of musicians, Indigenous girls, women up there, and thinking about how they could change the shape of music? And their own lives, too.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, I think music in general is for me, is medicine. It's always been able to, you know, whether it's healing a broken heart or it's just making you happy, want to dance, whatever it is, it's just an amazing way to open up the spirit. And I think that watching the girls do that for the first time, sometimes they've never even held a guitar. And there's nothing cuter than an 8-year-old, by the way, trying to hold a bass guitar that's bigger than she is. But, yeah, I mean, watching them and giving them the tools to start, perhaps, a journey through music is rewarding. But, you know, also, Indigenous Girls Rock Camp may not create a whole, you know, mess of Indigenous female artists, but hopefully it gives them some tools to be strong and to thrive at whatever they decide to do. But I do hope, because I am a musician, and you're right, I think women oftentimes are, you know, the backseat of music, and we have to work really hard to, you know, showcase our options and our abilities. Honestly, I think that's what I'm hoping Indigenous Girls Rock Camp opens the door for.
We're talking to Kelly Jackson right now. She's a singer, songwriter, philanthropist, and tribal advocate. And you were the historic preservation director for the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. How did that particular job affect the music that you were making at the time?
Oh, it had a huge impact. I worked in environmental protection for like 15 years, and I think wanted to use music as a form of storytelling. So my first album, Spirit of a Woman, has some content song about, you know, historic some tragic and some celebratory messages, but I wanted to use music as a way to share story. My first album has a song called Gawin Ni Wajasin, which is I Don't Want to Go. It's a tribute to the government boarding school and its impact on tribal communities.
I don't understand. Why did they take our moccasins? I don't understand. When will I see my grandmother again? Baby,
and this is one of those. It's a track that really hits you hard in the heart. Can you tell us a little more about the history and what it felt for you to write this song?
Yeah, I had been working on restoring the government boarding school at Lac des Flambeaux. We called it A Legacy of Survival. It's interpreting the impact of the boarding school on Indigenous communities. But honestly, I was doing research and found this letter that was written from the superintendent, or from a tribal member to its superintendent saying, you know, we don't understand what right do you have to take our children. So in the late 1800s, the United States government made it mandatory for children 5 years and older to be collected from tribal homes and taken to residential schools. And that went on for nearly three generations. It destroyed language, family structures, culture, connection. And it really hit me when I read the letter about this family fighting for their child. And I couldn't imagine someone coming to my home and taking my daughter. So Gawin Ni Wajasin, I think, is a story about a young boy's journey through the boarding school. And it, you know, from start to finish, I think it was a very moving song. And I still have a hard time singing it live because obviously it is very moving. And I have elders oftentimes usually don't make it through the whole song and you know, that emotional bridge. But I also think there's a sense of healing that, you know, we really need to recognize as a community and a culture. I also don't think that you're ever going to read this in history books in, you know, schools. I didn't know anything about the boarding school, and I'm tribal. So, you know, having learned about it and realizing that it's important to share that message, I thought, what better way to do that but through music?
Yeah, it's an incredible song.
Thank you.
Well, as we start to wrap up, you've been thinking these days a lot about environmental activism and stewardship of the land. And I understand you went out to Standing Rock and you supported the protesters there. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're thinking about your role as a musician and how that might dovetail with environmental activism?
Well, you know, that whole trip was so pivotal to, you know, my experience as an artist, but also just as an Indigenous advocate in general, feeling responsible to the environment. But, you know, I went out there with my heart in my hands. I wanted to do anything I could to help. And we volunteered at a couple of different areas in the camp. And it just didn't feel like quite enough. And I thought, you know, there is something I can do that's, you know, more on my journey, which is music. And so actually composed for the first time more of a pop song called Wake Up, which is about not just about Standing Rock, but it's about being environmentally conscious. We talk about corporate industry and its impact on the environment, but we also have to be mindful that we as individuals can impact change. And that means we have to accept responsibility for taking care of Mother Earth individually. And that's what the song is about. And I'm really excited about it because it's been nominated for Best Single of the Year by the Native American Music Awards.
Ah, congratulations.
Yeah, so thank you. I'm really excited. And also, we have a music video that also has been nominated as Best Music Video Performance. So I'm really excited about sharing that message as far and as wide as possible.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be part of the series.
Kelly Jackson is a singer, songwriter, philanthropist, and tribal advocate. We're listening to Kelly's latest single, Wake Up.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we finish our first Wisconsinite series with conversations with Native American veterans in the state. You can hear all of these interviews at WPR.org/first.
We'll hear how country music stars are reacting to the mass shooting at a country music festival and why they may be in a unique position in conversations about gun control.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 7, Kate and her guests look at the complicated relationship between the federal government and the territory of Puerto Rico, especially in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. That's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll hear from an environmental group about a new bill in the state capitol that would allow people to build in certain wetlands without a permit. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.